Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello everyone and welcome to the Phileas Club. This is episode 85 for March 2017. Hello everyone and welcome back to the Phileas Club. This is a show where we get people from different parts of the world and we ask them what's been happening in their country, what's been making the news in their media, and what they think about the things that have been happening in other parts of the world. And hopefully through all of this, we get a little bit of knowledge and a little bit of perspective on what we know and what we learn. My name is Patrick Beja. I am currently in France. I am, I'm actually French, I suppose. I say I suppose because I move around a lot. But of course, as usual, when the show is at its best, my co-host for my favorite co-host is here, and that's Turkey from Saudi Arabia. How are you doing, Turkey?
I'm doing good, Mr. French guy.
You sound
you are very much French. Yes, you are.
Ah, trust thank me. You, thank you. You realize that I have not one drop of French blood in me, right?
I know.
So it's always funny when people say,
"Wait, we need to do a DNA test."
I guess so.
We both know Lebanon has a lot of European blood in it.
That is true. That's true. So thank you for being on the show, Turkey, with your, I was going to say uncharacteristic, but it's characteristic energy. You have so much energy, you could be English with your famous English phlegm. But anyway, all right, let's keep going. Charles is here as a revenant, welcomed back host from the days of yore before the great hiatus of the show of 2012, I think. Charles hails from Australia, and he's kind enough to stay up late-ish to be with us. How is it going, Charles?
It's going very, very well, and I'm pleased that you were desperate enough to dust off the cobwebs of me and drag me from my revenant grave to join you for the evening.
Well, I'm very glad you agreed to put off your restful sleep, quite literally, since it's late in Australia, to be with us.
And, all good.
And finally, we're welcoming a first-timer on the show. Marlene is here from the Netherlands. How's it going, Marlene?
I'm fine, thank you.
So we were talking a little bit before the show started, and I was trying to figure out exactly what it is you do. I'm still not exactly sure, but my understanding is that, well, you're from the Netherlands and you make things and you cook things and you're generally channeling your artistic energies in creating stuff.
Yeah, I work part-time and in the meantime, I make a lot of stuff for people that I care about.
That sounds like, I was going to say like a lovely thing, but really what I'm thinking and what a lot of our audience is thinking, that sounds like a bleeding heart liberal is what it sounds like.
Well, I am Dutch after all.
Socialist.
Basically, you're trying to help people. I'm really glad we have you on the show, Marlene, because you're going to be able to tell us about what happened in the Netherlands, which was sort of the pre-written story, the continuation of the story of the rise of nationalism in Europe, the US, and, you know, with Brexit and President Trump. And then it was supposed to be the Netherlands and then France. And it didn't quite happen in the Netherlands. And we don't know exactly what's going to be happening in France in a few weeks. But let's say for me personally, what happened in the Netherlands was probably a positive thing. and we'll talk about it a little bit further so you can explain exactly what happened. Because if I'm being 100% honest, not sure I quite understand it. So it's good you're here to clarify things.
I'd love to. Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's a good thing because I think lots of the international media got it quite wrong. So I hope I can help explain something.
Excellent. So we'll get back to that in a little bit. Before we do, though, we do have to mention the news from London with the attack that happened a couple of days ago. I don't think it's worth spending too much time on it. We are obviously going to mention it because I don't think we could not mention it. But the feeling I got, at least from here in France, everyone talked about it, of course, but there was a little bit of a, you know, a fatigue, or maybe not even a fatigue. It's like, well, business as usual is what we said before we started the show when we were talking about it. And that might sound insensitive, but maybe it's because it's not a huge, you know, bombing attack, or it's still absolutely tragic, but it didn't feel so. On the one hand, here in France, it didn't feel like a huge tragedy. It was a tragedy, but not like something that gets everyone that touches everyone in the way that the previous terror attacks have. Again, others might have been more tragic, even if you can put a scale on this. And the other thing I want to mention is that people seem to be reporting on it in a very measured manner. You know, I've heard way more, you know, let's not overreact. Let's make, you know, let's keep our not business going, but let's make sure we don't let them win. Let's not be affected by this so much that they would be justified in or satisfied in their actions. And that's not quite the reaction I've seen in the past. So I'm curious if you guys have seen the same kind of you know, get the same feeling from what you've seen in your media. Yeah, Marlene.
Yeah, I think in the Netherlands it's been the same, and maybe that is what's like the headline. It's happened again. Again, it's terribly sad. And again, we struggle with how to react. But it's sad to say that it doesn't surprise us anymore.
Mm, yeah, I guess it doesn't surprise us, and it doesn't even affect us quite as much, you know, as it did in, and again, it's a smaller attack. So I want to go to Turkey in a second, but before that, Charles, you live very far away, even if you are part of the Commonwealth, I guess, right? I'm not mistaken.
Well done. Correct. Yeah. And there is an affinity with England. No question. So perhaps it had a little bit more currency here. The other thing that played into the currency of the story was that I think it was January, in the city I live in, which is Melbourne, there was, it wasn't a terrorist attack. It was just a guy who was a reasonably troubled soul, did pretty much exactly the same thing insofar as he drove his car through a crowded city street along the footpath, and with pretty much the same result. Four or five people were killed, tragically killed, and around about 30 or 40 injured. So the event struck a chord, but as a terrorist attack, it was very much reported the same way as you've expressed. It was just the facts, and almost a bit of, yes, this has happened again, so maybe this is the world we're living in now. As far as the reaction goes, let's just get on with things. I think that's pretty consistent with how London responded to the bombings in, 2003 or thereabouts. A much more significant event, but they a lot of people there made the point of, you know, we're not afraid. We're just going to go on with what we've been doing and take it in our stride.
It's with the election campaigns going on. Of course, a lot of the candidates were asked about terrorism in general, and I'm talking about France, of course. What a lot of people said was a lot of the candidates mentioned, you know, mentioned that I think absolute truth that we didn't want to talk about before, which is there is no way we can guarantee zero risk, right? There is no way we can guarantee our citizens that this will never happen again. And with the implication that chasing that illusion is useless and kind of can be dangerous even for liberties. So, and it's, I think it's the first time that I'm seeing this being expressed in a wide way. And I think this was before the attack. So, you know, I think, of course, things might be completely different if we do get another attack in France. We've had a few ones in the past few years, but it was kind of reassuring to me that what seems to me like, you know, they're still extremely determined to fight terrorism, but they're determined to fight it while acknowledging that you can't put, you know, one military for every person in the street and follow them around, and that will fix the problem, right? This is not necessarily the right way of doing it. There's a lot of questions still, but it seems like the right approach is being considered a little bit more than before, or what I consider the right approach. Turkey, what about you? Did you guys discuss the London attack or not at all?
No, we did, of course. It's just like everywhere else. It's reactions, horrible. This is not something that, being a Muslim nation, this is a lot of people's reaction was, this is not something that Muslims need at the moment. This is stupid, idiotic, barbaric, and so on. But at the end of the day, anyway, it's just another day for terrorist attacks. So it's something that is expected. The only thing about it is that we really need to be more vigilant and work around it and fight it. That's basically it. And continue with your lives. So basically, that's the main point, is to continue living and continuing the way you are. Because that's the mentality here in Saudi. Saudi is not, like everybody knows, it's not like we don't have terrorist attacks. Even Saudis, we usually on occasions have terrorist attacks. And we just learned a long time ago that one way to fight it is to continue on your normal life. Because the day you are afraid, the day you start reacting to it badly, that's the day when you are actually losing to them.
All right. Well, I guess that can be the final word on this story specifically. Let's move on to our main topics. And I guess I'm going to take the first one, since I did mention the French elections, because these elections are really, I don't want to say crazy, because it's inflammatory, but they're really unexpected and really unusual. Basically, what's happening, without going into too much details, is the fact that the two main parties are basically not really in the race anymore. And remember that we have many different parties, and in our elections, we have two rounds. So there's the first round where any you can vote for anyone that has gotten enough signatures to be represented in the election, and that's signatures from elected officials. You have to gather 500 of them. And we have 11 candidates that managed to do that this time, and that's not an unusual number. So we have 11 parties. We have, oh, not 11 parties, sorry, 11 candidates. We have five of them that are serious or big candidates. The two of them that would have been traditionally the biggest ones are the ones from the Socialist Party, so the traditional left wing, and the one from the Republican Party, which is the traditional right wing, obviously. It's basically like the Democrats and Republicans in the US, if you put it in the context of France. But because of different reasons, those two candidates who were elected during primaries are now not in the lead. There is one candidate on the far left who is above the candidate of the left-wing party in the polls. And there is, of course, the candidate in the far right, which is Marine Le Pen. I think a lot of people have heard about her, who is above, well, everyone else for the first round in the polls. And the biggest surprise, really, is the candidate of the center, Emmanuel Macron, who is basically being painted as a horrible right-wing Republican capitalist by the left, and being painted as a terrible left-wing socialist nut job by the right, basically the continuation of the existing government, which he has been a part of, by the way, for a little bit, but he was criticized in that government as being too right-leaning. So basically, he's really trying to magically manifest the center in the country and make it matter. And what's incredible is that it's kind of working. That guy did not have a party a couple of years ago. He was almost no one. You know, he used to be a banker. He studied in big schools. He was part of the government, but he didn't. He appeared out of nowhere a few years ago, and what he managed to do was provide an alternative to the big parties while not being an extreme version of those parties, neither on the left or on the right. And so for everyone who is disappointed with the traditional parties, of which there are many, many, many people, just like in, I think, every other election we've seen in the past couple of years, he, in the center, provides the quote-unquote reasonable alternative to the parties, whereas traditionally you often only have the extremes as alternatives. So this is the picture we have now. Of course, we've seen that the polls have been wrong many times in the previous elections. But currently, the traditional parties are at the bottom of those five big candidates. So it's looking likely that after the first round, the biggest candidates will be Marine Le Pen and that guy in the center, Emmanuel Macron. And in that scenario, Marine Le Pen would lose, according to the polls, on the second round in the runoff. It's, of course, possible that this won't happen and that we'll have the most likely second one would be the right-wing candidate who is embroiled in many different affairs, not affairs like sexual, but issues of illegal activity and getting his wife to quote-unquote work for him when she didn't really, and he would get the salary paid by the government, etc., a bunch of things. Presents that he got, basically suits and things like that he got for high value when he didn't declare it to the ethics commission when he should have, a bunch of things like that. He's saying this is being manufactured to put me out of the election, taking a really victimist approach, and we don't know if it's going to work. It's looking like it's not working according to the polls, but God knows if we can trust the polls. So basically, again, the two main parties are being taken out of the election, and it's like, it's not quite as big as if the Republicans and Democrats were out of an election in the U.S. Of course, it would be impossible in the U.S., but it's kind of on the same-ish level. It's really surprising and really strange to be living through this crazy election here in France. So I'm wondering if you guys have heard about this. I'm guessing not so much. You're hearing about the strength of Le Pen, which is undeniable, but anyone? Yeah, Charles.
I've heard some.
Oh,
well,
but seriously, Patrick. No, sorry, Charles. Seriously, Patrick, why are your elections so dull? It's not even interesting as much as the U.S. elections.
Well, I don't think anything
you need,
can
you
be
need
as...
to learn some showmanship from them.
I don't think anything can be as quote unquote interesting as the U.S. election. Honestly, we had the big debate, a few days ago. And I watched it. It was 3.5 hours. And I was so relieved that, of course, you know, we had a few moments where people raised their voices and they were a little bit talking over one another. But overall, it was like people talking about issues, proposing solutions, which were good or not, but discussing things in such a serious manner after having seen the deplorable spectacle of the Brexit debate and the US election debates and, you know, the discussions. I was watching this and I was like, even Marine Le Pen was like, I disagree with her vehemently, but she's, you know, she's exposing her views in a way that makes sense. It's crazy. And I was looking at all of the different candidates and I was thinking each of them has something interesting to say. Each of them, I could take some of what they're saying and think, yes, that makes sense. And that would, you know, anyway, yes, it's not as interesting, quote unquote, as the US. Charles, you wanted to say something.
Positively dull, really. The only bit of news that makes it down to us, by and large, is that Le Pen is doing well or doing better than expected, but not likely to win, which is pretty much consistent with what you said. But being the diligent person I am, I did a little bit of research and found that there's an opinion poll that says that 43% of French voters are still undecided. That's staggering.
It is, and it's very true.
And that's the sense that you get. So would you be guessing on an unexpected result?
It could very much happen. I mean, as we've seen, even when we have polls until the last couple of days, or at least in the US, there could be an upset ultimately in the elections. So I don't know. But the thing is, as I mentioned before, we vote a lot. Like, we come in droves to vote, and it's not unusual that 70 or 80% of the people come to the polls, especially for the presidential elections. And I think what happened in the other countries was that the people who are usually tipping the balance didn't show up and didn't vote. And I'm hoping that this isn't going to happen in France. So even with the undecided, I think the undecided might tip it towards the Republican candidate. I don't see them tipping it towards the socialist candidate, but it might happen. It might even go to the extreme left-wing candidate, who surprisingly is incredibly... Well, I shouldn't say incredibly popular is surprising, but he has so much charm. He's so clever. He's so genuine. He's crazy. I mean, I would say he's crazy, even though there are many things that are interesting about what he's saying, but he's kind of, well, as I said, extreme, but so I don't think he will take it, but he is, if you want to give a middle finger to the establishment, he would be a way of doing it, just like Trump was. And just like Marine Le Pen is. So I want to hope that things are going to be reasonable and we're going to elect the center guy. He has my preference because he's the one that seems the most measured and reasonable.
So 10 years ago, Patrick.
I know, right? Mm-hmm. And it feels like this is the last chance. If we elect him and he doesn't make things work, next time, it's going to be one of the extremes. Turkey, you need to leave in 15 minutes. You just came to say hi. So very quickly, Marlene, I'm wondering how you've been following the things in France, because, of course, with your elections, I'm guessing France is going to be the second act of spring. And then we'll go to Turkey to ask him what's been happening in his corner of the world. But first, Marlene.
Yeah, I'll be quick to give him some time as well. I always love his stories. I think the Dutch definitely reveled in being like the first country to look at before France. We are a tiny country, and oh boy, did we love all that international attention. I think there is definitely extra attention. We are a trading country. We are very much dependent on the European Union. So stability in the European Union is very important to us. And it also means that the rise of anti-EU sentiment has been very, very worrying for a particular part of Holland, especially in government. So yeah, I think we do see it. And I also think the dullness, I think it's just a matter of, we have so many more parties. I mean, you have many parties in France. We have plenty more in Holland, which means that it never ends up being such an extreme winner-takes-all two-party race as the system results in the US. I think that's also part of it. There's always space for a measured opinion in between the many voices, but that makes it less extreme, I think.
But yeah, I think that's the way it works out also in France, because there are a lot of people who are very angry at many things, but it turns out since you have a lot of different voices, then you always manage to find, you know, the as I was saying, the strange things about the debate was that they all agree on a few things. You know, you have five different big positions, and even the two extremes on the left and the right end up meeting in their kind of different degrees of hating the EU. You know, it's so you have those two extremes who hate each other, who end up saying, yeah, yeah, I agree with this, what you're saying about this part of the thing. It's anyway. All right. I did want to talk very quickly about healthcare, but I'm going to do that after we've given a chance to Turkey to tell us what's happening in Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia. Well, not that much is happening that's worth newsworthy, other than, let's see, two main topics recently. One is not that important, the weather fluctuations. We had a lot of rain, a lot of sandstorms, and a lot of weather changing between cold and hot. So,
What's your opinion? Other than that, what's the country's opinion on climate change, just very quickly?
On climate change, to be honest, I don't think anybody believes in it in here. Okay. I think they're all Trump. I think the majority here is Trump.
All right, fair enough.
Keep in mind, we do live in a desert. People don't... The changes, mostly when we get changes here, the climate changes is usually beneficial to us. That means more rain is moving to our areas. So nobody's going to complain that much about climate change.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
I think the biggest news has been the U.S. Declaring electronics bigger than a phone not allowed in a cabin for flights directly from, I think, eight Middle East countries direct to the U.S. That's the biggest thing people are talking about, and people are really going crazy over it. Did
crazy
you hear about
angry?
It?
Angry? Yeah, yeah, of course. I think, I mean, I follow tech, but yeah, so there. Yeah. To summarize, basically, for seven or eight countries, as you said, people can't take their electronics bigger than a phone in the main cabin. They have to check it into the luggage, and it was justified because the intelligence community found credible threats of attacks being perpetrated by those means. And there aren't adequate security controls in those countries. That's the justification.
All right. Here's the problems we're having. All right, let's start with the problem number one. Let's say you put a bomb in your laptop. Are you telling me he can't blow it up if it's in the luggage, but he only if he has it in his hands?
Are you asking me?
No, I'm just saying. This is the first thing. If there was a real threat, why are they allowing it to go into the luggage and not allowing it into the cabin? That's their first problem with people here. Problem number two. One of the countries or the airports they're banning is Abu Dhabi Airport, which flies Etihad. Abu Dhabi Airport, you actually go through pre-clearance. You actually go through immigration and customs, U.S. customs and U.S. immigration. So they are the ones who search you and check you. So are they telling us they don't trust their own people to do the right thing? So you have these two things. And to be honest, most people, and this is the theory that's going around, that this is an agreement between Trump and the U.S. airlines, who are really pissed at the Gulf Airlines, Qatar, Etihad, and Emirates, because they're taking over a lot of their business. And this is one way to slow them down into with their business in the U.S.
So the impression is that this is a commercial punishment for...
Yep. Mm. Yeah, because nobody is really understanding why is it okay to put in the luggage, but you can't carry it. Basically, if it was a security threat, they should have completely banned it. Second, why is no other country banning those? I've heard the UK is doing something similar. However, officially in Saudi, they haven't announced it in Saudi. And the UAE and Qatar are not on the list of the ban for the UK.
So you don't think the idea that some of those airports don't have adequate security measures holds up?
I believe Saudi airports don't have adequate security measures. I use them. Hmm. I have a huge problem believing Qatar, Abu Dhabi, and Dubai don't have good security. And as I said, Abu Dhabi, you actually go through U.S. security.
I guess it could be they could estimate that, you know, other than the passengers, there's also not adequate security for the building, you know, the airport itself. Maybe someone can infiltrate it somewhere else. Maybe there isn't security for the people doing the work on the planes, or, well, that wouldn't change if you can't.
Well, that doesn't affect. They would just smuggle it in the... So there's so much illogic in this ban that people are just wondering, what is it really about? And most people actually think it's a commercial thing. Mm. It's one way to fight these airlines that have been expanding like crazy and taking away a lot of business. And everybody, if you follow the airline industry, all the big U.S. carriers have been complaining to Congress and to the U.S. government about these airlines encroaching on them, taking a lot of their market share and so on, and accusing them of being supported financially by their governments and so on. So that's basically the problem. So the number one thing here right now, people are, if you go anywhere, that's what they're talking about, this ban. It's annoying a lot of people, it's pissing a lot of people off. And if you go and check airlines, like, I think, and some of them are taking it into good faith, Royal Jordanian has been posting sarcastic poems about the ban, making fun of it on their Twitter and Facebook accounts. Emirates Airlines has done two things. One, they made an advert. You don't need a laptop. We have all the entertainment you need in our entertainment system. Advertisement. They have initiated a system where you can have your laptop with you until the moment you board. Then someone will check it for you at the gate. So that's one thing they're doing there. So people are reacting in different ways, but it's really troubling that they picked specific airports, they picked specific airlines, and none of them are very known or common to have known that they had any popular terrorist attacks against airplanes in those countries. Well, except maybe Egypt.
Yeah, right. I guess the idea is to take action before those happen, but I understand. I mean, it definitely the issue here is you have to take it on faith that this is the reason and that there is justifiable evidence behind that reason. But what you're saying is in the media and the people, no one believes it. Basically,
the second theory is, since they're allowing people to check their luggage. With their luggage, their electronics. Some people are theorizing, okay, that's the actual reason. They want to have easy access without us knowing. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, you got to love a good conspiracy theory.
Yeah. Oh, but you should visit Saudi. We love conspiracy theories here in this country.
I mean, as far as conspiracy theories go, the bugging might be a little bit extreme, but it doesn't seem, I mean...
Oh, have you listened to the U.S. president recently?
Yeah, exactly.
Have you seen WikiLeaks recently?
Yeah. No, I guess it's kind of hard to claim that your tower was bugged and then say that bugging is, you know, a conspiracy theory. All right, cool. That was actually pretty interesting. Thank you very much, Darko.
No problem. All right, so I really have to run. It was a pleasure joining you guys.
Thanks.
I'm sorry I couldn't stay longer and chat with all of you.
Thank you for being here anyway, taking the time, and
no problem.
Give your wife hugs for me.
Will do. Take care. You too. All
thanks,
right?
Turkey.
Take care.
Yeah.
Bye.
See you, Turkey. Take care, all. Bye.
All right. So now that the annoying Turkey is gone, we can have serious conversations. So we're going to come back to Europe in a little bit with Marlene. I did want to mention healthcare very quickly because it struck me when I was listening to the debates in France that no one in our political spectrum would even consider the kind of healthcare that the Republican Party is proposing in the U.S. And I have the impression that it's the same all over Europe. And I don't know what the situation is in Australia, but definitely in Japan and any other first world country I know of, we have the kind of healthcare which is basically single payer. Or at least universal healthcare for sure.
Yeah.
And right, that's the case in Australia as well, I guess.
To make it simple, yes, there is universal healthcare available. There is some cost to a user, depending on what the service is. So, for the sake of the argument, you can go to a general practitioner and you can find one that will claim your visit against Medicare, which is what the healthcare system is called, or you can go to one that charges you a fee and you get some or all of that as a rebate. Same sort of structure applies for hospital visits. You can go public or private. If you've got private insurance, then that affects how you go. But fundamentally, there is universal healthcare. What's interesting is that a succession of conservative governments have made overtures about stripping back the benefits under Medicare and asking for more payment from the consumer, quoting aging population, rising healthcare costs, unsustainable budget costs, so on and so forth. And that has consistently not been something that's been supported by the general population and a fairly easy one to argue against. If political will changes, though, that might change.
I think there are definitely differences and debates and variations in all of the implementations of healthcare. I mean, in France, you don't get money for everything. Like, you can't get your glasses, or dental care is relatively poor unless you have an additional healthcare provider, which is also heavily regulated. We have Mutuel, which provide you with additional things but you have to pay for it if you want it. So basically, universal healthcare is kind of basic, but it ensures that if you get really sick, you will get the care you need. And then if you want glasses or, your teeth tended to, then you'd better take additional. The essential things are going to be done. And the reason I'm mentioning it is that I've had a couple of conversations with people on Twitter arguing that healthcare should be a choice. Subscribing to healthcare should be a choice that individuals make. And that, to me, seems beyond the scope of the healthcare you want to have in place. This really sounds like an incredibly strange idea to me, because it goes beyond. And honestly, I really hope that people listening to this from the US will trust me when I say this, or at least understand what I mean. And I know it's difficult because it's so polarized in the US, but this goes beyond political leanings. It's not about being a Republican or a Democrat. The principle of healthcare doesn't work if you can choose to opt into it or not. It is ridiculous. Of course, someone who is healthy will say, well, I don't want healthcare, or might say this. But ultimately, it's not about, I choose this and then if I need it, well, I'm gonna be cursing here, so cover your children's ears. But you can't say, "Well, I'm not gonna subscribe," and then if I get sick, I'm fucked. No, you're not fucked. Of course, we have to take care of you. You know, as a society, we're not like, this isn't hyperbole, but we're not going to let you die in the street, right? This isn't being hyperbolic. It's literally, if you get cancer, we're not going to let you die in the street. It's, again, I'm repeating, it's not hyperbole. Without healthcare, you die in, you know, in the street or your home or whatever. And we can't let you, I mean, the result is that you get bankrupt or you get, you know, you pay so much money that you don't have enough to pay for ultimately more than the care, more than that, and you still need the care, or maybe you're healed and you're bankrupt. Either, you know, I guess if you have enough with selling your house to pay for your healthcare, that could be considered, well, you made the choice and now you live in the street or you're poor. Fine, that's a choice. But really, a lot of the time it costs more. And that's because healthcare is indeed expensive, but just in the same way that police is expensive, education is expensive, military is expensive. And I really think it's reasonable to think that healthcare is in that same realm of infrastructure where you need everyone to chip in, because if the healthy don't chip in, then obviously the sick don't have enough. And it is something that everyone is concerned about. If you're healthy now, I mean, in your life, there's a very good chance that you, and almost a certainty chance that one of your the people near you are going to be impacted and are going to need healthcare. This isn't like, well, if I ever need to, you know, go to the moon, then I'll figure it out at this point. It's not this incredible scenario. You are going to need healthcare. So, and I'm saying this as looking at it, not just from Europe, but I really think from the rest of the civilized world, like the rest of the first world countries. Healthcare is infrastructure. It's like police. It's like firefighters. It's like military. It's like all of this. You need everyone to chip in, or it just does not work. It can't work if your reasoning is, well, you know, let people decide what they want to pay, or if they want to pay, right?
Patrick? Yes. Am I correct in understanding that this struck a nerve with you?
You know what strikes a nerve with me is that this is considered, it seems like it shouldn't be a partisan issue.
Yeah,
it really shouldn't.
I understand
know?
That.
Yeah. And that's what, no, it's not even, you could debate abortion, you could debate the death penalty as partisan issues, but really this shouldn't be one. So I'm wondering if, you know, I'm going overboard and you guys disagree with me, but Marlene, what do you think?
I think it's
on the logics of it, you know, on the logics of everyone.
Definitely.
It doesn't work because the argument on the right in the US is, well, I should be allowed to decide whether or not I pay. And my response is, well, you can't decide whether or not you pay for the police. And the question is it the same thing? For me, it's obvious.
To me, it absolutely is. And what I find interesting is, I think that also in the US, as in other Western countries, probably far beyond that as well, if you have a car, you must have car insurance.
Right.
And I find it completely fascinating that exactly as you say, as this this notion seems to be so divisive in the States, which indeed to me also seems like a completely basic feature that a healthy state should facilitate. And I mean, you can debate then in what form and in what way and what system and in all these things and what should be covered and what shouldn't be covered. But in the basics, and on just the basic rationale that it only works like any insurance, like home insurance, like car insurance, like all these things only work if we all chip in. That's the entire basis of it. And, you know, you don't have to buy car insurance if you don't have a car. makes total sense. But that's a little, like, that's a problem when it comes to health, because you are alive. you will at some point, you know, need something.
I think the argument would be, yeah, but with car insurance, it also insures you against damages you might do to someone else. Whereas with healthcare,
which you also do when you get sick, because indeed, when you get sick and you don't have health insurance, you will still be taken care of, and that is pushing a large cost on society.
Charles, what about you? Is it also somewhat logical to think that everyone should like chip in, just like, again, with the police? What, the state doesn't ask you, hey, do you want to be protected by the police, or are you good with being robbed? Like, no, you're not asked. You're like, you pay because you live in this society.
I would love to mount an argument that disagrees with you just for the fun of it, but it's very, very late and my brain can't do that right now. I completely agree. I think it's in a society that is economically strong enough to support a healthcare system, then it is a given that is provided. We talk about, you mentioned the car analogy and said that you know, that makes some sense, because, or it can be argued that also insures you against damaging others. In the situation where, for the sake of the argument, the primary income earner of a household suffers as a result of you know, an illness or injury, the health insurance system or the healthcare system does exactly what car insurance does. It protects their family from loss of income, potentially loss of house, loss of lifestyle, loss of so much. So that insurance that is a health insurance has flow-on effects not just to the individual but to everybody in their network, whether it be their employer or indeed their employees, if they're an employer, their family, their friends, so on and so forth. So that idea of extended protection, societal protection, certainly exists for healthcare just as much as it does for car insurance. It's a brilliant analogy.
Well, it's if nothing else, I know a lot of people who listen are from the US. If nothing else, and even if you disagree, do realize that this is apparently the opinion of, you know, us, and yes, bias, whatever you want.
Leading liberals. This isn't,
you know, I really don't think, and that's what I was getting from in the beginning, no one on the political spectrum here, you might have people arguing we should, you know, slow, bring it back a little bit, or not insure this thing as much, or maybe get people to pay a little bit when they do get benefits from the healthcare system, or these kinds of things. But that's as far as it goes. And as far as I know, that's the case in every, again, first world country. It's interesting. I was talking about this with a guy on Twitter, and I was saying, oh, you know, this is incredible. That's how it's working. I don't understand it. And they were getting angry at me and saying, oh, but, you know, this Obamacare is crap. And I was like, okay, but why, how? And then he was like, yes, but Trump Care is crap. And I was like, okay, so what do you want? And he's like, well, I'm a libertarian, and I think this is one of the few things that is so essential to societies, it should be part of infrastructure. And I was like, what? So we agree. And it was funny because if they're listening, hey, thanks for keeping the conversation. It started off really heated. And as usual, you know, when I keep going in those heated conversations and trying to find out why it's so heated, we ended up to an agreement. But What that person said was, it's probably the only thing we'll ever agree on, because I'm a libertarian. I have, you know, very different opinions than you probably. But on this thing, I agree, you know, it's essential. And so it was funny. It was a funny anecdote. But yeah. And anyway, so you guys in America have, in the US, have had a lot of debate about this. And I really think if there is, you know, three things that could be taken out of the political divide debate, I really think this would be one of it, and probably at the top, because the way you're talking about all of this is honestly doesn't make sense. It is crazy, and it has become crazy because of the political divide that you guys live in. So anyway, that was my hard take on it. Let's get back to crazy European politics with Marlene. And what the hell happened in the Netherlands?
Yeah, so if I may be so blunt and throw you guys a little, what have you heard that happened in Holland?
So there was a guy who was basically like Trump and Le Pen, and he was supposed to win the election, but that he didn't, so people were happy.
Okay,
Charles, what about you? What's your summary?
It saddens me to say that it was not reported.
Oh my lord!
Oh boy!
Now,
I was personally
aware of the I can't remember his name, but I was personally aware of the far right candidate and the apparent momentum that he had, but that was a story that I heard on radio going back a couple of months. The actual results, I didn't hear any reporting on at all.
All right. Fair enough.
We're a very long way away.
Yeah, you definitely are. And there will be many, many, many things that are incredibly important in Australia that do not filter through here. So that's completely understandable. I also understand that it was reported in France, indeed, because
parallels with
there's a lot of parallels being drawn,
and so, also it is Act 3 of the 4 or 5 or 6 acts of nationalism in the world. So
yeah, the next populism domino was supposed to go. So yeah, so indeed the big question was will the next populism victory be won in Holland, and I think many international but also Dutch analysis initially reported, no, see, we halted it, we stopped it, because indeed the far right candidate, the party from Geert Wilders, who you can just call Wilders. I know Geert is really difficult.
anytime I hear someone speak Dutch, it feels strange. It's all blah, blah, blah. It's very, very interesting.
Oh, yeah. So Wilders' party did... he did not win a majority, and he did not become the largest party.
So this was a parliamentary election, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm right. Sorry. Mm-hmm. You're totally right. Yes. Yeah. So in Holland, we do not pick our prime minister. We vote for our parliament and only for the House of Parliament, the second chamber. It has 150 members, and it is a representative democracy that is proportional, which means that if you get on the day of the election, 150 of the vote, you will get one seat in parliament. So there's so that's the threshold. The threshold is 150 of all the votes that have been cast. The result of this, and there's not like a second round as with the presidential elections in France. Mm. So the result of this is that I think basically since the 80s or 90s, what happened is that the major parties have continued to splinter and splinter and splinter and splinter. There were, during these elections, there were 28 different parties on our ballot.
28? Jeez.
28. After the show, I'll tweet a picture of the actual ballot. It is a joke, honestly. It is more than 1 square meter of paper.
Wow,
it's a bit like our Senate ballot paper here.
So does it mean that on for the Senate ballot, you also vote like you can vote just like the first name on top of the list of your party, but you can also pick a different person by name?
Yeah, so of the, gosh, I don't know, let's punt and say there are about 80 or so candidates on the Senate ballot paper, which, by the way, is done by state. So there's, 6-7 states, so each state has a similar number of candidates to choose from. You can either pick one party or one candidate from above the line, and then their preferences are applied to all the other candidates, or you can go through the somewhat laborious task of putting a number against each of the candidates below the line, which I don't think anyone does, but I could be completely wrong. They made a slight change to that in the last election, which meant that you could actually preference 1 to 5, what they call above the line. But the other option is to pick individual candidates by your own preferential system. Yeah. So it sounds quite similar in a way.
Yeah, indeed. It does sound quite similar. So all these people must be on the ballot. And in the end, indeed, 13 different parties were instated in the new second chamber, which was just instated yesterday. I think all the members were instated. There was a really, really, really big shift, mainly because one of the biggest parties, which has been one of the biggest parties since forever, is the Labour Party, and it had 39 seats, and it now has 9. So that was an incredible loss, and basically many, many other, probably all other parties won because all those votes were dispersed amongst all these other different parties. Mm. In Holland, we have we call it the a polder model, which is named after all our how we create land from water. Okay. So it only works if we all work together. So it's all based on consensus. So no party will ever get the majority. So if you want the majority, so that's 76 out of 150. So you just have to collect and negotiate with other parties to come to a coalition government.
What a strange idea. It probably wouldn't work anywhere else, or I guess it works in many other places. But so basically, the right wing party that, what's his name?
Wilders.
Okay, Wilders. Let's go with his last name. Yeah. But it's not like he was completely defeated, right? He still got.
He's the second largest party.
Right. Yeah. So it's not like he didn't win, but was he predicted to get, he wasn't predicted to get 76 seats anyway. So
no, what was predicted is that he, up until I think 2 weeks before the election, it was predicted that it would be a two-way race between the liberal, the conservative, the economically liberal yet socially conservative party.
So right wing, basically.
Yeah, I think it's right wing. They're probably the most Republican party that we have.
So between them and Wilders.
Yeah, and Wilders, that would be the two-way race. The other party is the one who we've had as a prime minister for the past few years. That party still was the largest now, even though they also lost 10 seats.
Okay.
So all the large parties lost. But where those votes went is the reason Wilders didn't really lose, or rather that populism didn't lose, is that that Conservative Party has gotten more and more right-wing in the past few years in an attempt to stop losing votes to Wilders.
You know, that's what's happening in France as well. The Republican Party and the candidate here is veering farther to the extreme right. He's not quite, you know, as far as Le Pen is, but he's certainly doing what you're talking about as well.
Yeah. The one of the other largest parties, the Christian Democrats, they also turned more right. And sometimes, like, just putting in like little things like, you know, children should start singing the anthem again when they start day in school. Like, you know, like sort of seemingly not as evil populist notions, but they all try to sort of reach toward those really right-wing voters. And the problem is that all of that still continues. There's another party who got into a new party by a guy called Thierry Baudet. He had two votes two seats in parliament. He is insane. Like, if you thought like the quotes by Trump about how to treat women, the whole grab them by the pussy thing, if you thought that was weird and evil, this guy goes way beyond that, and he still like gets two seats in parliament. So the entire political spectrum has turned more to the right. The Labour Party used to be the big left, like sort of the central left party, and it almost always ended up in government. That has been like completely broken down from about 40 to 10 seats. On the other hand, there have been other parties on the left or center left that have won, but their winnings have not been as great as the loss of the Labour Party. Mm.
So what do you think happened? Maybe I think for people listening outside of the country, why do you think that assured quote-unquote victory of becoming the biggest party in the country for Wilders, why do you think it didn't materialize?
One of them, I think, is just polls, you know.
Polls being wrong as they were.
Yeah, and they developed. Some other parts is that he has been, the last 2 weeks before the election, I personally did not see as many as many outings of his party. The problem is he's a one-man party. Like political parties, they always have like a list of members, really big member groups. But his party has only two members, himself and an organization that he is the chair of. So that means that just in the organizational structure, nobody else gets to make real decisions and stand for things. He hardly has any other people from his party that are, of course, in his name in parliament, for example, reaching out and doing interviews. So I think that is one of the things he
didn't have the media set up to follow up on his popularity.
Yeah, which is strange because, like Trump, he has always been a person that the media just, because they were fascinated with his weirdness. He always could count on the media like listening to him. But he has not changed his story one bit. He just kept saying the same things, and I think the media halfway through, you know, after all these years, said, you know, that's what he said. It's what he always said. It's just not newsworthy anymore. Mm. So the way he normally could pull media towards him, I think that has changed a little.
That's very interesting. So what you're saying is it seems like it has more to do with a media strategy and communication strategy maybe than his, you know, the country awakening to the, you know, terribleness of the policies he was proposing. I mean, I'm sure there was some public opinion being expressed in the votes, thank God. But there's also this element you're saying of just exposure.
Yeah, I think exposure is one thing. But the other thing is he is, amongst many people, he's notorious for not having any policy ideas.
Oh, his entire, okay, that's a problem.
Yeah.
So what does he say?
He has his entire political program fits on like one piece of paper, just one piece of paper. And it includes a lot of things. It has like 11 bullets. And it includes a lot of things that are just not possible because of our constitution. Like closing mosques and banning the Quran.
banning the Quran. Like that's one of his bullet points.
That's one of its bullet points. And if you then ask him, how are you going to try to implement this? Because first of all, you're not even allowed to make that policy by the Constitution. Mm. It's like, well, you know, we all know, everybody knows how I plan to do stuff. Well, no.
Okay.
And so, I think that meant that all he could do was sort of rehash those 11 points. Mm. And then whenever there came a follow-up question, he didn't have an answer.
And so I guess there are two things that jump to me with this description. First of all, he seems to not be ready for political office at all. He has, as you're saying, more controversial ideas that are sexy, but not anything beyond that, which is not the case for our situation. Mm-hmm. Marine Le Pen has a very apt political mind. And the other thing is, he still became the second biggest party in your elections, even with those things you're describing of not being able to follow through, to follow his ideas and develop them. He's still the second biggest party.
Yeah, so. and that's a problem. And not only is he the second biggest party, but he was able to pull the entire political spectrum to the right in the past years. Mm. He has tried to govern before, indeed, also with that with our conservative party, the VVD. Almost all the other parties have said, we will never be in a coalition with Wilders because we cannot agree on basic rules. Mm. So that's a problem. But also his populism has splintered, just like the votes for the left have splintered over many different parties. Because the other parties have turned more to the right, because we have newer, smaller parties than Wilders gaining seats, even if it's just two seats, you know, it chips away at what he could have considered his seats based on his story.
How do you think this will impact on the way that the Netherlands is actually governed? Will it make a change to policy, or was this sort of veering to the right simply for election purposes?
No, it's a really interesting question. So what's going to happen now is, in fact, much more exciting than the actual elections, if you're slightly politically inclined, because that is a forming of coalitions.
Wilders doesn't have the numbers to make a coalition, clearly. Oh.
I guess
if no one
wants to work with him.
Yeah.
That was my point. Sorry. Poorly stated, but you mentioned that he didn't have support to make a coalition. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, but the problem is because the system has been so incredibly fractured. Almost nobody has. It used to be quite normal, like it has been quite common in our history that two parties together would have enough votes to form a majority coalition. More recently, you know, it would have been three parties. But there is, in fact, at this moment, no real situation of even three parties being able to have a majority. They need four.
Interesting.
And that means that everything is going to splinter. So what we see now is that the coalition talks have actually started. We have our conservative party, sort of Republican style. We have our Green Left party. Clearly they're on the left and they have a high they put the environment at a very, you know, big priority. Clearly, those two are basically polar opposites. Then we have Democrat 66, which is a progressive party, but is it's socially progressive and economically centrist. And then we have the Christian Democrats. So those four, they're basically all over the spectrum, but it's still the only viable combination.
Yeah, that is.
So the Labour Party won't join with the Christian Democrats here. Yeah?
Mm. No, they won't, because they've been struck down so hard that basically everybody's saying, you know, you should really try to find some new ground and develop a program, because they were actually in government with the Conservative Party in the past 4 years.
Mm.
And those were just the two of them together, and they had a majority, and the together they almost lost 40 seats. So it's insane. Yeah, yeah. On 150, that's incredible.
So it's so not like
25% of the parliament.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not. Yeah. It's not like, you know, it's true that for us, the way it was reported on was, yay, the populists were defeated. And it really feels like the what you're talking about, which is he managed to push the entire spectrum to the right. I don't know, you know, I don't know that it's him, but there's certainly kind of, his shadow is all over Europe,
yeah,
and maybe all over the world. But I wonder how much of this is, in a way, democracy working, because possibly because of terrorism, and we always get back to that, but possibly because of terrorism, the concern for these matters is present in the population, you know, and it's not necessarily that the way we look at it is, ah, Le Pen is doing this and Wilders is doing that and Trump is, that is true to an extent, but there's also, it's also them responding to the reality of the opinions, the way I would put it, being affected successfully by terrorism, by the terrorists' intent, which is make you
causing
afraid,
fear.
Make you, cause fear. And you know, we were talking about the attacks in London and people reacting maybe a little bit more rationally to those, and hopefully this will continue. But yeah, basically, which is it? Are they the ones igniting the fires? I mean, are they, you know, the populist parties, are they igniting the fires? Or are they growing because they have the hot air created by the fires under them? This analogy is breaking down.
I actually don't think it's breaking down. I think you're completely right. I think it's both, because what we have seen that the left, and I think that goes all around Europe, what the left has always been saying these past years is, I know you're afraid, but you don't have to be afraid.
Mm.
But if you really are afraid, it's really not helpful if somebody tells you don't have to be afraid.
Mm.
That's just not addressing, even if the source of fear may be incorrect. I'm not even saying it is, but it may be incorrect. The feeling of the fear in that person is real. So you have to deal with the real fear. And I think the left has done far too little of that.
It's really funny because when you're saying this, it reminds me very clearly of what, was it Newt Gingrich was saying during the run-up to the election in the U.S. The journalists were telling him, you know, but the situation is this and that. And he was saying, but that's not how people feel.
Yeah.
And basically, It wasn't put exactly like this, but his reaction was, I think it was Gingrich, but his reaction was,
I remember the segment.
Yeah. It was a famous segment that was retweeted a lot, saying, but how can he say this? But I think what we've learned since then, and what you're echoing again, is that the feeling, no matter whether or not it's based on reality, can be a powerful platform and is real. So I don't know that. I don't have a solution for any of this. But yeah, sorry,
but,
Charles.
Charles, you were asking, like, what will the consequence be of this?
I'm particularly interested in whether that means that policy in government will also shift to the right, or whether we can just say, rightio, this is what we had to do to get elected, to form a coalition, to do whatever. So now let's just get back to governing the Netherlands the way we think it should be governed.
No, I'm afraid that's not going to happen. And that we had, I think it was 2001 when we had a political assassination of a man called Pim Fortuyn. It was also very internationally covered back then. He was...
Yeah, we got that one, by the way.
Yeah, you got that one. Yeah. Yeah. He was one of the first populists, I think, that really made a statement in Holland. And one of the things he used to say, addressing immigration, was our country is full. Back then, if you'd say that, that was like an incredible... You couldn't say that. It was like cursing, like political cursing. You could just not say our country is full. It was degrading. It was bad in every way.
Full, as in we can't welcome any more immigrants.
Yeah, exactly. It's full. We will close down the borders. We cannot take any more. Hmm. Right now, nobody none of those 150 MPs would even blink at that statement. So what you see that the entire discourse, even though populists have rarely actually governed, the entire discourse has changed. And I think it will have an effect. For this time, it's interesting because the conservatives can only really enter a coalition with really progressive left parties. So I'm hoping that will middle out.
Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was thinking it also had another effect that I didn't see coming. And I know this is one that's close to your heart as well, Patrick, because, the number of women in parliament is always a measure of emancipation of women within a society, a parliamentary society. It turns out that I think we were at about 70 out of, 65 out of 150, and we're now back to just over 50 from one election. And that's the result of the loss of the Labour Party, because they had an almost 50-50 gender mix on their their party, amongst their MPs. And the more right-wing parties have considerably less women on their list. So,
all right. Well, this is going to be an interesting one to follow, and certainly it gives a certain light or shadow on the future of I was going to say France, but Europe really. So
It gives pause.
Yeah. All right. And actually, before we go to Charles for what's been happening on the other side of the world, there is a very strong, I think I expressed it last time on the show, but there is a very strong sentiment amongst people who are voting for a very strong left-leaning socialist policy. There is a very strong feeling that governing in the middle is what is bringing the far right to power, meaning that it is not dealing with the, I don't agree with it, but it's saying we've tried all of this before, it's not working, we have more inequalities, more unemployment, more poverty, and that's what's fueling the rise of the extremes. And my issue with it is that I'm not sure their policies would tackle these issues more adequately than others. But that's, my own opinion. And I think there is merit to the idea, or at least, it should give people pause and get them to think about it a little bit, in the argument that, we've been doing these center-right, center-left policies for 20, 30 years, and we're still on the same path. It's understandable that people would say, well, there's no reason that this would change if we keep doing the same thing. And that's one of the reasons why some people are saying, well, I'm not going to vote if the option at the election is between center right and far right. F all of them, you know, they just let them break everything and we'll see what happens afterwards. Because I know that if I keep going with this, and my response is, well, just like you had the issue with any, all of these previous elections, if your option is to keep stabbing yourself in the foot or take the knife to your gut and your heart, the gut and the heart being the far right, I say you keep the least bad option. And some people have been telling me, yeah, but how long do you keep this going? And my response is, if the other option is, you know, the extreme populism, which I honestly don't think would be beneficial in any way, would be very detrimental to, well, you keep doing it forever if you have to. That's my answer. You know, you don't think, well, I'm tired of it and I stop. No. You keep going until the end of forever if you have to. And that's why I... anyway, all right. Patrick is getting heated. Charles, hey, what's been happening in Australia?
At a different time and place, Patrick, I'll have a long rant with you about the nature and failing of democracy in the current political environment, but now is not the time.
Well, you know, we're having very strong arguments about this in our... political discourse during the debates. That's, you know, one of the reasons I'm saying the discussion is refreshingly, thankfully adult about this. You know, we have people asking for a new republic. We have people arguing about the way the constitution should be put together, the way people should govern. And we have people defending the, we have different debates and ideas, and everything is mostly respectful. So
debates have actually been about policy.
And the only thing,
disagreement simply for the sake of disagreeing.
Oh, there is some of it as well. Of course, I think there is some of it on principle. And there is also a lot of debate about the Republican candidate being quote-unquote corrupt, which I don't think, if I'm being 100% honest, it's not the worst corruption you've ever heard in your life, right? It's things like he employed his wife, and that made him, he quote-unquote employed his wife, that made him a few hundred thousand euros, maybe a million, you know, over the course of 20 years. And he got 50,000 euros in costumes from a friend, and these kinds of things, which are bad, of course. And I think the awakening of French society to these things is going to be positive in the long run, because we're going to be like a proper adult country, hopefully, and have some ethical rules in place that make us not be ashamed when we look at the Nordic countries. Maybe, you know, that's going to lead there. So these discussions are also happening, and one of the arguments is these are obscuring policy discussions, but the policy discussions are also happening, and they are respectful for the most part.
Good.
Right. Yes. Australia.
Well, when I knew I was going to do this, I thought I'd flick on the news, and so I did. And I turned on one of the commercial news stations, and the lead story, I kid you not, was about an aged stage and screen actor who hasn't really appeared for very long and who had just come out of hospital and was okay but may not act again.
Okay,
so
that sounds
we're not
important.
Exactly in a high sort of import news cycle at the moment, it would seem, and it takes a bit of digging to find something. I'm going to give you two options, and I'll get you to choose. Do you want to hear about the day that Elon Musk came to town to solve our nation's power problems, or do you want to hear about potential changes to our racial vilification laws?
Those both seem interesting. The Elon Musk thing.
Neither of them are, to be honest.
Okay.
The Elon Musk thing was the Twitter deal, right?
Yeah. He tweeted. Right. Has that gone beyond the promise of we can do it? And if you want it, just let me know?
Well, yes and no. He hasn't been taken up on that offer. Okay. However, that something quite similar, as in a battery farm and indeed a gas-fired power plant, are going to be put in place. But to give you a bit of background on this, late last year, so we're talking about a state here, South Australia, and South Australia has one of the highest proportions of renewable energy generation in the world. It took a coal-fired power station offline last year quite suddenly and relied on renewables, basically being wind and solar, to generate a fair chunk of its energy. Late last year, there was a fairly significant storm which damaged some of the power supply infrastructure. Nothing to do with the source of energy, but it caused a pretty catastrophic blackout in the capital of South Australia, being Adelaide and areas around there. Our current federal government, which supports fossil fuel energy, pointed the political finger at them and said, see, this is what happens when you go to renewables. You can't rely on the energy. And that sort of bubbled along for a bit. Whereas the state government was saying, no, hang on, this was about an infrastructure failure. It's nothing to do with the generation of the power. However, in February of this year, after a pretty long and extensive heat wave, which happens quite a bit in South Australia, to be frank, they started having brownouts because the energy generation, in fact, wasn't meeting the demand. And that was, in fact, as a direct result of the slightly intermittent supply that comes with renewables, particularly solar and wind. And that was the point at which Elon came in and said, I can fix your power problems. I'll do it in 100 days or it's free.
So the idea was you would get the batteries and store the energy you need when it's not being used.
That's right.
And then, because there's enough on average, is this that when there the spikes, then precise, the production right. is okay.
So that's the idea. But what this discussion has actually done is it's sort of lifted the lid on a whole range of energy issues that are starting to materialise. So you might remember that I said that one of the solutions in South Australia was to have a natural gas-fired power station that would help the on-demand capacity. Since that was put forward, it's turned out that Australia actually has a fair amount of natural gas resource, but it turns out that we're not actually keeping it. We're sending most of it overseas. We're selling it. And so having made the plan to put a gas-fired power station in place to help meet demand, the question was then, well, where are you going to get the gas from? Because we're not actually selling it to ourselves. We're selling it overseas. So that's created a whole issue around what we're doing with our own national resources, or natural resources, rather. The other piece is that in the state that I live in, which is Victoria, we are either fortunate or unfortunate, depending on your perspective, to have one of the largest brown coal reserves in the world. And so brown coal has been what we've been using to generate our energy for decades.
Is that better than black coal? Or
no, okay. No, it's actually worse. It's wetter than black coal. And there's been a debate for a very long time around the coal industry, because it's a very big industry here. Quite I think in the next couple of weeks, one of the coal-fired power stations in Victoria, which provides, let's call it 20%, I don't know the numbers, but a reasonably decent chunk of our electricity will go offline. The company that runs it has said it's no longer economically viable and doesn't fit into their plans of renewables and gas power production. So what we're entering into, and what I don't think we're quite managing to face into just at the moment, is there is no national strategy around energy production in Australia. There seems to be a bit of a mismatch between what individual states are trying to do and where their powers finish and end, and what federally they're trying to do. We have for a very, very long time argued over putting a price on carbon to give things like coal-fired power stations actually more certainty around their income sources, which is one thing that that does. Even though it does encourage cleaner energy, it also makes the economic proposition for an unclean energy more viable because it's they're dealing with more certainty. So there's a range of things that are going on here, and it's a kind of a watch this space and a lot of confusion, I think, at the moment, both politically and societally about what all this means, because no one quite knows at the moment. We're being told horror stories about 30% and 40% increases in electricity costs, more blackouts, so on and so forth. And it's going to be interesting, particularly over the next probably year and a half, to see where all of that lands and how, because our current government is pushing back so hard against renewables. Australia is a very, very large country and a very, very warm country, and quite a lot of it has quite a lot of sun. there's a fair bit of desert here. We could probably... And I'm no electrical engineer, I don't know for sure, but stuff that I read tells me that we could certainly generate and store enough electricity from solar alone to power most of what we need, and perhaps some on demand top up, but there's no political will to do that.
So let's get back to the really interesting part of this and the hero that we all need.
Elon Musk.
Yeah,
is he the coolest rich guy in the world or what?
But he said that he could fix it. Has that been met? Was it like, we'll see? Or like, I don't want to put too much stock into Elon Musk, but he seems to know a fair deal about stuff. And was he like reacting to something that wasn't the real issue, or is he seen as not someone serious, or like what's the deal that proposal?
I think it was seen as, so my reading of it was that was seen as a, oh shit, this guy's paying attention to what we're doing. Maybe we can use that idea, or that's an idea that we were already going to run with anyway. His actual offer, I don't think at any point was taken particularly seriously, but that is not to say that having a battery farm was never an option, because mm-hmm. it's certainly one of the options that's been taken up. Okay. Just taking up that particular offer, I think, was something that wasn't taken particularly seriously. Mm. And the way it transpired was he was actually goaded into saying that by a local billionaire who said, yeah, you think you can do that? Put your money where your mouth is. And he said, all right, well, I'll do it for free if it's not done in 100 days. But I think he was doing two things, to be frank. I think he was sort of a bit of PR for himself and Tesla. And oh, wow. I think he also genuinely cares about using renewables and storing renewables as an effective way of managing energy.
All right.
Charles.
So there you go.
If I may ask, what's the consideration, like how, like Patrick, you asked Turkey, like what's the idea about climate change in Saudi? So I can imagine that it's much more, it feels much more relevant in Australia. So why are they pushing back against renewables?
Our current government is a conservative government, and a bit like you were describing the parliament in the Netherlands, within its own ranks, it's quite split. There are some very far right, or, you know, in Australian terms, far right, which is not as far right as your far right parties are necessarily. But in Australian terms, there are some pretty far right people within the Liberal Party, which is or the coalition. It's a Liberal National Party coalition, and amongst those are climate change deniers. Now, what this translates to is that the government itself, or the Prime Minister and the cabinet of the government, in order to retain the support of their party and maintain their roles, have to make compromises. And so one of the compromises that's made quite often is around based in economic terms, it goes something like, well, we make money out of and we have access to cheapened energy using things like coal, brown coal, and so we will continue to do that because there is no economic imperative to do it and because it's cheaper for us to do that. And we don't need to move to renewables. Is climate change an issue? In Australia? Absolutely it is. Is it something that people care about? Absolutely it is. But do they care? And this is the frustrating thing about the electorate, and I'd be interested to see if yours are the same. Do they care about it as much as the amount of tax they pay? The horrible answer is no.
Well, yeah,
I think that in Holland, that was probably the change. The Green Left Party is making this a really big issue. And in that case, people have indeed finally, like the voters have actually made it a priority.
I would say a decade ago, it would have been a priority. The way the debate has shifted has focused people much more, I would say, selfishly as an electorate rather than societally and globally.
Yeah.
It's in France. And before this, I do want to mention, if you don't believe climate change is real and caused by humans, then that position makes complete sense. We can debate climate change until, you know, well, it wouldn't be I don't think it should be a very long debate, but we could debate it, I'm sure, for a long time. But that's a different conversation. But yeah.
Don't get me wrong, the vast majority of the population and indeed the vast majority of the politicians are not climate change deniers. There's no question about that at all. It is simply a case of where that issue sits in the political discourse, doesn't sit high enough.
For us in France, we are in a somewhat peculiar situation because in the 80s we went to nuclear. And I think we have a very large, well, I know, I can't remember exactly how much, but a very large part of our electricity is generated by nuclear power plants. So this, you know, the debate is whether or not we should keep the nuclear plants, and some of them are aging, so there's a debate around this, but how green is nuclear? And of course, it's not very, but it's a lot more than coal, for example, right?
Nuclear is a fascinating one
because from a carbon emissions point of view, it's as green as anything.
Exactly.
Zero carbon emissions.
Exactly. Well, except you have the nuclear waste you have to do something with, and we can't quite send it into the sun yet. So
No. What do you do with your nuclear waste?
Well, we probably send it to the bottom of the sea somewhere or give it to... Yeah, I have no idea. I mean, I think just
I hope
like...
some people somewhere do, though.
Yeah, I'm sure they do. Yes, they do. I mean, yes. It's as safe as it can be, which is to say probably not as much as we want it to be in an ideal world, but... I think we're now getting to a situation with renewable energies where it is conceivable that we could start a transition, which wasn't the case maybe, you know, 10 or 20 or 30 years, well, 20 years ago, because 30 years ago, it wasn't even a discussion. But so that's the overwhelming presence of nuclear power in France makes this debate very different from the debate in other countries. Anyway, I think this is going to be it for the show. We've had a good amount of discussions, I feel, and I hope the listeners have had a good time listening to us. Before we leave, however, I would like to give you guys the opportunity to tell us where we can find you online if you wish to let us know. If you don't, it's fine as well. But Marlene, what about you? Do you have any online presence?
I tweet when I am irked about something. and they are often similar subjects as you seem to be irked about. So if people appreciate that, they can follow me at Monksies. And I'm going to spell that because it only works in Dutch, I think. So that's M-O-N-X-I-E-S.
Excellent. And your that Twitter account will be in the show notes, of course.
Yeah. I'd love to hear from people because if anything, this show, what I love is getting into touch with people from all over the world. So if they think I'm wrong, please let me know. I probably get some Dutch tweets because I've been referring to our country as Holland, which is really only a small part of it. So
we
I'm
all
sorry.
Do it. We all do it.
I'm sorry. I should know better.
Yeah, I would like to echo that that sentiment. You know, we especially about healthcare, which I know is a heavy debate in the U.S. If you disagree with me and are, you know, if and want to make a constructed, respectful argument about why some people should be allowed to not contribute to healthcare and why it means the system works, that's the key part, I'd be interested in hearing from you. So please do come to the show notes or my Twitter account or anything to let me know. Charles, what about yourself?
I've almost entirely given up an online presence, but if you really want to troll me, you can. my Twitter handle is Extrepid, like intrepid, but the opposite if there were one. That's excellent. The theory. And I'm going to spruik something. If anyone is interested in supporting the not-for-profit that I work for, which is known as Eastern Volunteers, please feel free to visit www.easternvolunteers.org.au. Look at what we do, and if you feel compelled to, hit the Donate Now button.
Excellent. I'll include this in the show notes as well. Thank you very much to both of you. For me, it's Not Patrick on Twitter and Facebook, as I'm sure you know. You can also support the show on Patreon. If you think that we bring something to your daily lives, or at least to your political or world inclinations, please do consider to go to patreon.com/thephileasclub. Of course, this is a lot of work for me and to keep the show going, and I really appreciate every person's contribution, basically putting their wallet where their inclinations are. We always try to stay, maybe this episode was not as neutral as some people would have liked, but I really think it managed to give the opinion of some of the larger European population on some issues. So I hope it gave you a little bit of perspective on things you might have heard, whether you're in the US or other parts of the world. So anyway, if you appreciate this, do consider coming to patreon.com/thephileasclub. Every dollar counts. And if you don't have any money to spare, you can also go to iTunes, for example, to leave us a review with a few stars. You could do like J.M. Dalava from France, actually, who says, accurate and open-minded with 5 stars, addicted to all Patrick Beja's podcasts, the Phileas Club is one of the best with great guests, period, !! Proud to be a patron. We have a French term, which is patriot. It's a term we made up for this. I think it's pretty clever. So if you want to become a patriot as well, you can go to Patreon. If you want to leave a review on iTunes or on another podcast catalog, please do so as well, or talk to a friend about the show. It's always appreciated. Thank you very much to everyone. Thanks to you guys. Oh, and I forgot, of course, Turkey is Turkey Elballa, LLAA at the end. And you can follow him on Twitter. And Turkey is with an I, not like the country. So again, thanks everyone. Thanks for listening. And we'll be back very soon for the next show. Bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.